everyone. It is just, oh, December 17th. It's Tuesday. Lucky you, you're tuning into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. And I already shoveled the driveway and the walkway because we have about 2 inches of snow. So there's the weather report, but it includes shoveling. So I just want to let you know. I have to let everyone know. I shoveled first, and then I showed up for work. I'm such a beast of burden. People keep saying to me, what do you do for a living? And I go, wash sheets, clean toilets, and shovel. And then, of course, this is my avocation. I love doing this. But anyway. All right, darling. So on this December 17th, where are we going? Tomorrow's the big vote for impeachment. Pins and needles? No, I'm not.
Yeah, because I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. It's a nail-biter.
It is a nail. Well, you know, what's the song, Every Breath You Take, Every Move
yes.
You Make is impeachable. that's how I feel about Donald Trump. Of course, they were absolutely right. From the very beginning, he was impeachable because he should have been in jail before he ran for office. They don't get it. He should have been in jail a decade ago, you know. And the fact that we ended up electing someone who really should have been doing a perp walk and wearing an orange jumpsuit is really problematic for me. They keep saying, look at his coloring. It's orange. I go, oh, it goes with the jumpsuit he should be wearing.
Yeah. He's got the orange. Hair.
Oh, I tell you, it's unbelievable. All right. So I will be quiet. What's up with you?
I was reading an article by Jennifer Rubin in the New York Times, who is getting more and more prolific as the days go on.
Yeah.
And she was talking about...
She's really on a tear. Oh my God. She's a hoot, yes.
Yeah, and she, when she started with the Times, you know,
she was
so
conservative,
yeah.
Well, I think her outrage has sort of peeled some of
the scales off her eyes.
Exactly.
Well, but also, I guess if I were a Republican who was there with a good heart and because I believed in some things that Republicans do, government should be smaller, business markets should be able to play freely without government regulation, I might be conservative. But then I'd be so appalled to see my party taken over by this horrible person who is spewing hate all the time and engaging in actions that spew hate. And so I can imagine why she'd be even more ticked off than we are.
Right. Exactly. Well, the Democratic Party has no love for me, so I've been their agitator for a long time.
Well, that's
so
true.
I don't always play nice in the sandbox. That's my problem. Oh, God.
Anyway, so Rubin wrote this article about how Time magazine had given Greta Thunberg the Person of the Year. And while Jennifer agrees that that's a good thing, Thunberg is very impressive and she's
motivated a lot of people around the world.
Yeah,
yes.
And she's on an issue that is obviously of existential importance to our planet.
Right. It doesn't have a side. It's about life and death.
Yeah. But she says, I find it preposterous to assert that Thunberg had a unique transformative impact on public opinion in a way no other person has because – and I think Rubin's right on this – that there were a lot of people who were upset about climate change before Greta came across the Atlantic and in her boat and everything and got really real notoriety.
But she scolds better than a lot of people. She does. She does a very good job of sort of making
I agree. And she also has a lot of weight as a young person, as, you know, just a kid really, high school kid who is getting up there at the UN and Climate Summit and everywhere else and taking everybody to task for
talking. Doesn't she remind you talking of Joan of Arc?
Yeah.
She reminds me of Joan of Arc. There's this sort of righteousness about her that I kind of admire.
Yeah. But giving a more impassioned and the immediacy, the urgency of the issue, you all sit around and talk and you've been talking and having these summits and having these UN councils and year after year after year after year. And meanwhile,
we have hardly any time left
to avoid irreversible catastrophe. But anyway, her point is that there were other people doing this and Thunberg didn't really change the minds so much. And she thinks that there are two people – one of them's a group who really deserve it more because they did have more of a unique impact on the world. And one of them is the millions of protesters in Hong Kong and their leaders who have made a real difference for democracy and against the incredibly powerful Chinese government, which is no small task to take on. And week after week and month after month, they put their lives at risk to champion democracy. And they forced the Chinese communists communist government to relent on an extradition law. So Rubin's article says they were Time magazine finalists, the Hong Kong protesters. Mm-hmm. But frankly, in the course of history, she writes, these folks will be seen as far more the influential activists of 2019. Mm-hmm. And then the other, and this is an individual who she thinks is also worthy more than Thunberg, is Nancy Pelosi, which I found surprising for leading the way to this presidential impeachment, which is a very rare thing. And it's hard to imagine that it would have actually happened without Pelosi. And Rubin writes, the whistleblower unveiled the most egregious high crimes and misdemeanors in U.S. history, revealing facts that otherwise would never have come to light. Mm-hmm. And the witnesses in the House told the truth under oath, but they didn't ring the alarm. But her point is about Pelosi is that she skillfully managed the impeachment process, arriving at two tightly drawn articles of impeachment based on a set of facts that Republicans have yet to even substantively dispute. So revealing a corrupt president, impeaching him, pretty consequential stuff, she writes.
Well, she wouldn't be there without Donald Trump. I mean, it took a corrupt president for Nancy Pelosi to, you know, able to prove her mettle. And remember, she's in that job for exactly that reason. That is the definition of Speaker of the House. I mean, I hate to break it to you. This is not the definition of Greta. Okay? And it's not the definition, frankly, of those Hong Kong protesters. It is it's her job.
It is her job.
And I appreciate she's doing her job well, but this is her job. She's been tasked with this, and that is why she's in this position. And so I don't think she's unique there. I think there are a lot of people that could have done that. She just happens to be the person who was elected at the time and was able to basically, you know, find her backbone and find her strength and also use her skill set. But it is her skill set and her job.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Absolutely. The other thing about Nancy Pelosi is that she really has walked the fine line. Her skill set is really a powerful skill set of political genius, really, to walk that line between talking about impeachment and having it blow back and the Democrats just lose all credibility because all you want to do is reverse the election, which the Republicans are saying anyway.
Call me in 2020.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, seriously. And let me just say one more thing about Greta, because she said there are a lot of other people who have really sort of inspired us on the climate change issue. That was what they used to say about Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King wasn't the civil rights movement. There are lots of people who were really responsible for the
That's
civil rights movement.
That's a very good point.
Okay. Oh, no. Trust me. I, that was my first floor fight in 1984. Mm-hmm. So I just want everyone to know that was the pushback. Oh, if we have anything, Arnie, not about Martin Luther King, we should have Civil Rights Day.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I just want – sometimes that individual matters. And the reason why Greta is so powerful is this is a universal conversation, not just a conversation about what's going on in China, which is a very important issue, not just about the impeachment, which is a very important issue. But this is our whole planet. This is the planet that's basically sinking like the Titanic. And the thing that she represents is not only, I was saying, Joan of Arc, but she also represents not just the urgency, but that we are sacrificing the next generation. We have lost our sense of generational ethics. She will be the one to die. I will die a natural cause. Mm-hmm. She may not. And that is why I think she's so powerful.
Well, but also her strength. When she gets up and speaks to the entire world, people listen, and she doesn't mince any words. You know, it's not like we say that the politicians in Washington are mealy-mouthed and get up and stand up for what you believe in. Well,
this kid
is standing up for what she believes in, and you can't. You can't not notice.
You can't not, and then that's good. You know, I mean, I think about when I was running for governor and someone told me that my bumper sticker should have been a sign that said no more BS.
Yes.
You know, and that's kind of how I feel. I don't want to be soft anymore. I can't be kind anymore. You need to hear me. All right, we need to go.
I mean, you can still be kind. You just have to be firm.
Right.
Have a backbone, a spine, but
when a woman is firm. Remember, they interpret it differently.
Yes, they do.
All right, everyone. So I'm gonna do a shout out to Ralph. So Ralph sent me an article. This is one of our just phenomenal listeners, and it was an article from TheGuardian.com, and the title of the article was "A Black Woman Faces Prison Because of a Jim Crow Era Plan to Protect White Voters," and why I was excited to interview our next guest, our first guest actually, Sam Levine, who is a voting rights reporter for The Guardian, the U.S., was that I had just posted a couple of days before an article about the Texas mother, Crystal Mason, who is appealing a 5-year sentence for illegal voting. And I just thought, isn't this interesting? She wanted to exercise the franchise. And actually, the story of Crystal Mason is very much – is very similar to the story that we're going to be hearing about the woman in North Carolina. But both of them wanted to vote for a very positive reason. They didn't realize that what they were doing was illegal. No one had told them that they were still on probation from whatever their, you know, criminal violation was or felony was, and that they had to, you know, complete everything, not just be out of jail, but complete everything in order to legally vote. And nobody had ever informed them. So they thought now that they were out of the big house, that they were going to be able to finally participate in society because they had paid their dues. And it turns out, unbeknownst to them, you know, in the fine details that nobody shared with them, that it was illegal for them to vote. And I remember being so upset about the story about Crystal Mason in Texas that when Ralph sent me the story about North Carolina and Lanisha Bratcher, I guess I'm not sure exactly how she pronounces her name, who voted in the 2016 presidential election, 3 years later, she was arrested because she had broken a law she didn't know about. Joining us right now is the author of that piece, and I wish I had your job, Sam. Sam Levine writes for TheGuardian.org. His beat is voting rights, and this is, I mean, in a lot of ways, I love your beat, but it must be heartbreaking sometimes as you realize how we spend so much time and energy trying to suppress the vote, trying to make it difficult, and that that difficulty and that suppression usually has a black face or a brown face or a poor face, because obviously these people are looking at how they can pick their voters as opposed to having their voters pick their politicians. Welcome to the program, Sam.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So I was telling my audience that this is very similar to the story of Crystal Mason in Texas. And she went to jail for – was sent to jail for 5 years for also being in a similar position. So, Sam, why don't you walk us through the story of North Carolina, but more important than that, what you did that wasn't in the Texas story that I had read years ago and just recently is that you give the history of why these laws went into effect. It wasn't about protecting the integrity of the vote. It was about making sure that blacks didn't vote.
So in North Carolina, Lanisha Bratcher voted in the 2016 election. She registered during the primary in March of 2016, and then when the general election came around, she was at her church. They were having an event to get people to go to the polls and vote early, as many churches across the country do. And she went. She went up to the table where you sign in. She was on the voter rolls. She voted. Ms. Bratcher had no idea at the time that she was committing a crime. She was still serving probation for a felony offense that she never went. She wasn't in prison for.
Oh my God! All right,
and she says no one ever told her that she couldn't vote while she was on probation. 3 years later, the police showed up at her house, arrested her one morning.
Oh my God.
Because North Carolina prohibits people from voting if they have a felony until they finish their sentence entirely.
So let's talk a little bit about your piece. And, you know, as I'm listening, because she had no idea, she should have pulled the Trump defense. Every time Donald Trump does something, all his staff goes, oh, he really doesn't understand. Oh, he doesn't get it. He never really studied this. They use the ignorance defense for the president of the United States ad nauseum. And yet, isn't this interesting? Here you have a woman who had no idea that she wasn't permitted to do it because she was on probation, did what she thought was her civic duty, and there she is arrested. But where I want you to go is where you begin with the state's policy of banning people convicted of felonies from voting is rooted in a late 19th century effort by North Carolina Democrats to limit the voting power of newly enfranchised African Americans as a whole. So can you walk us through the history? Because I think people need to see there's a pattern and practice here. And the sad thing is it might have been in the 1800s, but it's now 2019 and it continues.
After the Civil War, there was a hugely growing African American voter bloc. African Americans legally gained the right to vote. And what started happening was states in the South started passing laws that didn't outright say you can't vote if you are black, but they found different ways to limit that newly growing voting power. And one of the ways they did that was by prohibiting people from voting if they had a felony conviction. It wasn't called a felony, you know, at the time, right. But they couldn't vote if they had been convicted of certain crimes.
Right.
A lot of states chose crimes to disenfranchise people that they believed African-Americans might be more likely to be convicted of. And it wasn't a secret at the time. You know, there was a lot of talk in the record, in political documents about protecting the white vote, the need to limit African-American voting power.
Well, let me do a quote that you have in your article, because I want people to hear the precise words, because they were so bold about what they believed. In 1898, everyone, the North Carolina Democratic Party spoke of the need to, quote, ready, rescue the white people of the East from the curse of Negro domination, close quote. I mean, they weren't subtle exactly, Sam.
No, it was very public.
Yes.
And, you know, that law in North Carolina, it's not, the law in the books say is not the verbatim law that was passed in the 19th century. It's been tweaked, it's been eased a little bit. But really the core of it, that people should be stripped of the right to vote when they are convicted of a crime and shouldn't be able to regain that right until they are done with their sentence, that remains on the books today. It has gone unchanged. And that's the case in North Carolina. It's the case in several other states in the country. Only two states, Maine and Vermont, allow people to vote while they're
incarcerated.
Prison.
Right. So let me ask a question. Isn't there a duty on the part of the state to inform people? So when you leave prison or you are on probation, your probation officer would say, okay, let's just go through the checklist. Here are the things you can do and here are the things you can't do. Maybe you can't leave this district. Maybe you can't take this kind of a job. Maybe you can't do this. By the way, you can't vote. And isn't there a responsibility to inform these people of these little tchotchke details that are very important, like exercising the franchise, but that they have an obligation to explain to the person who's on probation or has just left prison, these are the behaviors you're permitted to do, these are the behaviors that you're not. Every time I read the story about North Carolina or the story about Texas, none of them were ever told.
But they do have discharge discussions with the prisoners about what they can't do if they're on parole and everything, right?
Right,
Sam? I mean, how could they... Why did they leave this one out?
Exactly.
That's correct. And when I talked to Ms. Bratcher about this, she went through, you know, when you're put on probation or put on parole, they go through a list of things that you can't do.
Right.
You can't associate with other felons. You can't own a firearm.
Exactly.
Things
mm-hmm.
like that. And she said they never said you cannot vote. And I think what's most striking about Ms. Bratcher's case is that the State Elections Board in North Carolina does not dispute that she was not told. They very publicly in 2017 issued a report acknowledging that there was systemic confusion among probation officials, among probationers about what their voting rights were, and there wasn't really a formal process in place for notifying them. On top of that report, the State Elections Board sent a letter to the local district attorney in Ms. Bratcher's county, telling them all of this, saying that we have investigated nearly 200 similar cases. We have found that in many cases there's confusion. There isn't a policy in place at probation. And we have since made reforms since 2016. They've updated the materials. They have worked with local probation officials to put a more formalized process in place.
Right.
But the State Elections Board acknowledges that there were problems in the way that people were informed. What's unusual in North Carolina is that the specific offense that Ms. Bratcher is being charged with is what's called a strict liability offense. So they do not need to prove that she knowingly voted illegally or intentionally voted illegally to convict her of a crime.
Oh,
it's enough to just show that she was ineligible to vote and that she cast a ballot and therefore is guilty of a new felony.
So this is just – this is a crime. There's no other word for it. And what's so sad about this – and you even put this in your piece at The Guardian, very well written, by the way, Sam, is that you mentioned that this really has a chilling effect on blacks. What it's basically telling you is, as you point out, you know, all the states have different rules. There's no pro forma thing that you go from one state to another, and it's the same pattern and practice in every state. Every state does it differently because states control the voting process in their states. So again, you've got, you know, and most people don't necessarily live and die in the same state in which they were born. They may live in seven states. What are they supposed to do? Like, they're supposed to learn the little particular, you know, requirements for every voting pattern in every state? That's ridiculous. And in my state, they just recently found a couple, I think it was in 2018, that voted twice. They didn't go to jail. They got a fine. You know, there were two white people who voted twice. They knew damn well what they were doing. I mean, this is a woman who thought she was exercising the franchise the first time. She wasn't intending to break a law. She wasn't intending. And yet this is intentional with the strict liability so that people are afraid. I am afraid to vote. What happens if I was caught when I was 17 and did something wrong? Does it still follow me into the voting booth? And when you realize how many people are now warehoused in prison, more than during the time of slavery, you begin to realize this isn't about the person who actually did the wrong thing. It's about everybody else that says, ugh, should I risk it too? And now it becomes the question of, am I risking something? Because nobody tells you what the rules of the game are.
I think there's widespread confusion among
intentional
people. There's widespread confusion among people with felony convictions,
yes,
about what the rules around this are. And the criminal justice system is extremely complicated. You know, it's not, it can be really difficult to figure out if you've paid up on everything, if you've completed everything that you need to do, if you have all the paperwork in order to be formally, finally done with a sentence. And for someone who hears about the case of Miss Bratcher or hears about the case of Crystal Mason, the woman in Texas who was sentenced to five years in prison, if they have any uncertainty about whether or not they're going to be prosecuted, why would they risk it?
Yeah.
You know, voting isn't a benefit like a job or, you know, housing where there's some, you know, immediate tangible benefit that you get. Why would they risk their going to prison, falling back into the criminal justice system to vote?
Yeah.
And Ms. Bratcher, when I asked her about this, I said, will you ever vote again? You know, even once you're legally allowed to. And she says, I'm really not sure. You know, it just seems dangerous. Why bother? Why take that risk?
But talk about her husband. What did he say to her?
And her husband,
I love him,
says that, you know, they've talked about it. And he says, he's told her, isn't that the point of this law?
Yes.
That if you are now afraid to cast a ballot, they have succeeded in intimidating you from voting, and that's exactly what the law is supposed to do. And if you don't vote, then it will have worked.
So, I mean, right there, the thing that kills me is the idea that there's strict liability for this. That is just so wrong. It is so wrong because, as you just point out, there are so many things that you are being told when you leave prison about what you can and can't do. And the fact that they never, ever included the fact that she couldn't, you know, vote, that was – and knowing the perils of what would happen if she was and part of it is, remember, we used to talk about prison as rehabilitation. We used to talk about prison as bringing people back into society. She wasn't even in prison. She was on probation. The idea was for her to participate in the most normal of ways. She was getting a better job. She was moving up. She was proving herself. All the things you want to do, and part of what you want to do, because she even heard it from her church, was that she had an obligation to be part of this country, and that meant exercising the franchise. So doing the right thing became the wrong thing because no one ever took it upon them to explain to her, oh, by the way. And that, to me, just makes it even more of a crime. And it's a crime that the state has committed, not her. So I'm kind of curious, as a result of this, you mentioned at the end of the article that there were a number of people with felonies who had been indicted for illegal voting in 2016. Obviously, maybe North Carolina won't change the rules, won't change the laws on strict liability. Have other nonprofits stepped up and said, we are going to assist anyone who's ever had a felony, anyone who's ever on probation, we will work with you to let you know whether you can vote or not in order to protect them? It's kind of like a, when you go dial 911, you know what I mean? I almost feel like I want to dial, you know, vote 11, and just to make sure so that people aren't chilled, but they're given the opportunity to at least question and say, is this okay? And then someone hold their hand and walk them through it.
There's a group called the Campaign Legal Center that started a website earlier this year.
Good.
It's called restoreyourvote.org, and it walks people through a checklist. You can select your state, and then
Good.
It asks you about the terms of your conviction
Good.
And kind of walks you through a step-by-step thing on whether or not you can vote again. So that's one really helpful resource for people.
Restoreyourvote.org?
Right. It might be restoremyvote.org.
We'll check it. I'll post it on Facebook. Again, this needs a billboard. And it needs a billboard in places, especially where people feel the most vulnerable, so they know that, you know what, we want you to vote. We don't want you to be hurt. Here's the place you check.
Yeah. And one thing I'll add is that a lot of states have moved recently to ease the restrictions on felon disenfranchisement. New Jersey, this week, both chambers of the legislature have passed a law to allow people to vote once they are released from prison. Nevada and Colorado did something similar that went into effect this year. Florida used to have a lifetime ban on people voting with felonies, and voters repealed that ban last year. So there is a lot of movement across this country in revisiting these laws, I think because of the discriminatory racial origins, and really reconsidering, is it appropriate to continue to punish people once they are released from prison and not allow them to vote? And that there's just been a lot of activity reexamining that in the last few years.
Sam, I'm going to call you a lot. Here we go. In the title of Sam's piece at The Guardian, a black woman faces prison because of a Jim Crow era plan to what? Protect white voters. Thank you so much for your work. And thank you. And keep writing about this because we'll keep banging the drum and be your echo chamber. Take care, Sam Levine. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Oh, God, I get so upset. And we keep hearing that the African-American vote is so important going into 2020. And in a lot of ways, that's why these stories are – they come out and they want to chill the vote. That's exactly what they want to do. And they'll do anything to disenfranchise
people. Yeah, and it's amazing that in 1898, when these laws were passed, they are open and honest about why they're
We don't want you to vote and we're going to find a way to do
it. Yes, and if you look at Sam's article, there's a cartoon in there of the Negro rule being a vampire that is out to destroy
the white
good white people.
All right, on that note, we're going to have some good labor history next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1944. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt rescinded Executive Order 9066. It had forcibly relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans into internment camps. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the government considered Japanese Americans a national security threat. By 1942, many were given less than a week's notice to sell and store all property. Whole families were rounded up and taken away to desolate areas in the west and southwest of the United States. Up to this point, many Japanese Americans in California were employed in the agricultural industry, some as tenant farmers. They were responsible for 40% of all produce grown in that state, whose crops were valued at $40 million annually. Over 6,000 farms, consisting of 200,000 acres, were confiscated. Once interned, they were subjected to dire living living conditions with little in the way of running water, sanitary facilities, or medical care. They were subject to forced labor in the construction of camp buildings and cultivation of near barren lands. The government hoped to make the camps self-sufficient. In Poston, Arizona, they were made to build the infrastructure for Colorado River Tribes Reservation in order to consolidate other tribes onto the land. When Japanese Americans were finally released, most found their stored belongings stolen and their homes, jobs, and farms confiscated and redistributed. After the war, they continued to face violence, job and housing shortages, and racial discrimination. Ronald Reagan would sign the Civil Liberties Act in 1988. It acknowledged that internment was based on, quote, race prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. The act served as a formal apology and sought to distribute billions in reparations.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Cutting carbon pollution is essential for slowing global warming. But Julio Friedman of the Center for Global Energy Policy at Columbia University says the world cannot realistically stop emitting enough carbon pollution in time to prevent dangerous levels of warming.
Many of the most persistent and difficult sources of emissions have no good options today.
So he says it's critical to also remove some of the CO2 that's already in the air and oceans. Nature can help. For example,
we know we can plant trees. They do the job.
But he says it's not feasible to plant enough trees to rely on them as the only solution. So Friedman says new technologies will also be essential. For example, scientists are working on ways to suck CO2 from the air and permanently store it underground or use it as a raw material for industrial products. These technologies are not a substitute for reducing emissions, and they require much more research and development before they can be deployed broadly. But Friedman says investing in carbon removal is a critical part of maintaining a safe climate.
It is complementary, it is additive to everything else we have to do with mitigation.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
All right, everyone. Someone get me a doctor. This is the Attitude Authority artist and producer Ken Bars. Who sings that?
That is Van Halen, and Ooh. It sounds like he's really desperate for a doctor.
You think so?
He must live
you
in a rural area.
You think? That's probably true. All right, so let me explain why I grabbed this guy from TheConversation.com, which you, by the way, know I adore that website. The title of the piece by our professor from Penn State was, "As Rural Americans Struggle for Healthcare Access, Insurers May Make Things Worse." Well, that's assuming you're insured. Anyway, joining us is it Simon Hayter? Is that correct, Simon?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
He teaches and does research on public policy making process, regulatory politics, lobbying, interest group politics, and, of course, healthcare policy. So let me just say something, Simon. I love this story for 1,000 reasons. And the reason I love this story is that back in 1982, I gave birth to my first daughter. And I had my first daughter at Cottage Hospital in Woodsville, okay? So you can just picture it. I mean, the reason it's called Cottage is it's not much bigger than a cottage. The reason it's called Woodsville is that it's in the middle of the woods. And sadly, I had my first baby born without health insurance. That's a long story. But anyway, but, you know, I had treated my body like a temple. I'd gone to the doctor. We went into debt to do this and whatever. Then I went to Cottage Hospital 2 years later in 1984. And guess what, Simon? I had insurance. And what I'll never forget is I'm being brought into the delivery room and I hear one of the aides go, "She's got insurance. She's got insurance." Ah, that was the 1980s. And I knew it was terrible then and that the hospitals were struggling like crazy. And then I look at stories now that are coming out of, you know, websites around my state and listen to the title of this one from New Hampshire. Critical condition. New Hampshire's rural hospitals struggle to keep pace with the changing market and figuring out how to survive. So let's talk about rural health care, because despite the Affordable Care Act, despite, you know, the expansion of Medicaid, it doesn't seem to be trickling in places where it needs to trickle to, i.e. rural America. So you can begin anywhere you want, but that's my story. I got my rural piece. Now give us yours.
Well, I wouldn't say I have the same story, but I have a similar story. Now, I've lived in three predominantly rural places. I lived in the Central Valley of California. I've lived in West Virginia. Now I live in Kent State College, which has, you know, a huge university, but it's still in the middle of nowhere practically.
Yeah.
So a lot of the things you're talking about, you know, I see firsthand. That's kind of where my research is going.
So, you know, here's the thing. We passed the Affordable Care Act. And everyone thought that this would be kind of the answer. And then we found out that a lot of states, unfortunately, a lot of Republican states, did not include the expansion of Medicaid. So, for example, the highest number of uninsured in America today is Texas. Guess what?
Yes.
Texas didn't do the expansion of Medicaid. Oh, shock of shocks. And then we're finding out that they had this attack on things like Planned Parenthood so that, you know, any kind of health care that might have been available for nothing through places like Planned Parenthood are basically disappearing in front of our eyes. So let's talk about what are the challenges for providing rural health care, because obviously just by the nature of being rural, everything is a challenge. It's a challenge to get internet access. Sometimes there are food deserts. I mean, just by the nature of being rural. But health care is more than anything else a significant life and death conversation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct in a lot of ways here. You know, living in rural America comes with certain challenges that are just connected to living in a rural place. You know, there's fewer things. Things are further away. You have fewer choices, all those kind of things. You know, and as you pointed out, we tried to work on this and kind of improve it a little bit with the Affordable Care Act to at least make sure that, you know, people that are challenged getting coverage in these rural areas have access to health insurance either through exchanges or through the Medicaid expansion. And as you pointed out as well, you know, not every state did that. And the situation is certainly worse in those states that didn't do it. You mentioned Texas. Same is true in Oklahoma and Alabama. You know, that's where rural health care is really struggling even more than places that you mentioned and that you and I live in. But what our research, you know, shows is the situation that just having an insurance card doesn't necessarily mean things are going to, you know, get much better for you very quickly. For you, you know, it turned out it was better because your insurance, you know, was accepted in your hospital and all those kind of things. But things have changed dramatically, and the healthcare field has changed dramatically over time, and it's turned even more into a business. And so there's lots of situations where both providers and insurance companies are trying to take advantage of patients, and you kind of get stuck in the middle as a patient.
Now, explain to me why having insurance and living in a rural area is not necessarily a prescription for being able to be covered for a doctor. What are the insurance companies doing that are making it difficult for people in rural America to be able to find out that they are like, I mean, the word I hate now with insurance is called in-network. So is this an in-network problem and your network doesn't include your rural community?
Yes, that's kind of what our recent research showed. This, we, you know, we looked at both the Affordable Care Act, we looked at commercial plans, and we also looked at Medicare Advantage to get comparisons. And we looked at in various states. And what we found is basically that in a lot of cases, and strikingly large number of cases actually, there are doctors, of course, fewer doctors in their metropolitan areas, but there are doctors in rural areas. But a lot of insurance companies do not actually include them in their networks. And then when they're not in your network, you kind of have two choices. You know, you either, or more than two, but they're not, none of them are good for you. You either don't get care, you either drive very far, or you go to a provider that's not in your network and, you know, you get billed for it.
Right, right. Well, you know, so I'll give you a story that just happened about a year ago. So I had a young friend who lives in Vermont, and she was going to one of the local small, relatively rural hospitals. And just before the delivery, I find out that she's been moved to Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center in Hanover. So I thought she had a complicated birth. And she said, oh, no, Arnie, there's no more OBGYN services anymore in our hospital. So that's the other thing. It's not just that you don't have doctors in network, but now you're seeing more and more of these rural hospitals basically triaging and making a decision that maybe either they don't have enough births to pay for the OBGYN, or, you know, you're talking about the in-network and out-of-network. So now what you have is you think you have access to health care. You've been going to the doctor thinking you're going to deliver at the hospital, like, you know, maybe 6 miles away. And then literally 48 hours before your delivery, they say, oh, by the way, you have to go an hour. You know, I mean, it's so life-threatening.
Yeah, and you know, you're pointing this out for delivery units, which is obviously one of the things that really scare for a lot of people. What we're seeing is across healthcare providers, the options and choices in rural America are shrinking.
Yeah.
Hospitals, nursing homes, you know, all those things are getting more and more challenging to access. Expanding coverage is one way to kind of stem the tide a little bit, but we really need to start thinking about long-term solutions. How we want to provide care to, you know, millions and millions of Americans that are living outside of the large metropolitan areas.
You have a really good point here, and I want to cry because these are the communities that are going to vote for a Donald Trump who has done nothing to – and I don't want to make this a political conversation, but I'm forced to because it turns out, you know, the politics of healthcare is why we have growing problems with each passing day. And you have in your piece at The Conversation – that part of the problem in rural areas is the demographic problem. Now, listen to this, everyone. Over the last several decades, many rural areas have lost a large share of their residents. In many areas, the young are moving away, leaving an aging population behind. Besides being older, those staying behind are poorer, have lower levels of education. To make things worse, they're also more likely to be uninsured, and they tend to be sicker, exhibiting higher rates of cancer, heart disease, stroke, chronic lower respiratory disease. It comes at no surprise that their life expectancy is generally lower as well. So by definition, you need – it's kind of like – you know how you have a child with special needs? That means you need to give them more resources. That means you need to almost have people specially. In this situation, it's like it's spiraling worse and nobody's paying attention. And yet for whatever reason, they're afraid of changing the current healthcare system. But the current healthcare system is still missing them and to some extent getting worse with each passing year despite things like the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, that's certainly true. You know, the two developments are really going in opposite directions. Things are really getting worse from a health perspective for people living in rural areas, but the healthcare system is also getting worse for them. And so it's, you know, turning into a perfect storm where we're not having important conversations about, you know, how we want to think about delivering care and allowing people to access care in those areas. And it's very, very heartbreaking because, you know, you and I live in those kind of areas and we've been there for a long time and, you know, it's your neighbors.
So how do we address this? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, does the commercial system work to addressing rural areas? And the reason I think about this is I almost think about this as the postal service. You know, the postman goes everywhere, or the post person, all right? And there are a lot of places where they go. There's, you know, only maybe three people on their route because they're in rural whatever, Cucamonga. But that was the whole beauty of the postal service, was that we all were able to participate. And because it was sort of a government-driven program, they realized that the country was their obligation. For private companies, there is no obligation for the country. There is no obligation for rural America. Their obligation is to stockholders and profit. So as you are doing this analysis, tell me, how the hell do we get health care to rural America? What is an answer? And is there a private sector answer? Because I suspect there isn't.
It's really, really challenging because, you know, I've done other work on public hospitals, but the problem with public hospitals is that they're also competing with private alternatives, and private alternatives, public hospitals to public hospitals, you know, they're really responding to the market, and they're trying to avoid certain patients that are costly, right. And they're trying to locate in areas that have lots of insurance. So it's quite, quite challenging. There's no easy answers here. It's going to cost, you know, lots of money and lots of ways of thinking about how we can improve this. Arguably, you know, there's some services we will never to adequately provide in rural areas, like advanced heart surgery, you know, transplantation. And, you know, we need to think about those services, and we need to perhaps invest in better infrastructure to transport people to the centers that have those kind of things. But there's certain things, you know, that you need in spread out across the country. Maternity wards. You need a hospital, you know, because it's a life and death situation. So, there's, you know, as I said, there's no easy answers. It's going to cost money, and we need to start thinking more creatively and honestly about, you know, the implications and what we're willing to spend on it. And, you know, if left to private incentives, you know, doctors often don't want to practice in those areas. It's very expensive. Lots of people don't have insurance.
Yeah.
The businesses that provide insurance are closing in those areas often, leaving lots of people uninsured. So, you know, a purely private a solution doesn't really exist to this kind of problem because the incentives are all structured wrong for them.
So I was talking to I have a couple that's staying with me from Bristol, England, and we were talking about, you know, going bankrupt from lack of health care, or, you know, being worried about losing your health insurance when you lose your job and whatever. And they kind of look at me with this stare like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because they have universal health care in England.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is that I went back to the conversation I had on Monday where, you know, everyone keeps saying that Boris Johnson is like Donald Trump, except when you actually look at what Boris Johnson ran on, he ran on giving, you know, millions and millions of pounds to the National Health Service. To expand the National Health Services, in part to make sure that it was more accessible in rural areas. You know, it's like so ironic that exactly what he ran on to have this huge sweep for conservatives is that he was investing in the thing that everyone is trashing in the United States. Like, we can't do Medicare for all. We have to stick with the private market. Nobody wants to give up their insurance. I don't want my insurance. I don't like my insurance. I don't want to know the word network. I hate that word. And yet, when you're looking at rural America, it is sort of a lose-lose. They don't have the hospitals. They're out of network. Mm-hmm. They're sicker. They don't have better transportation. They have to travel farther to get a doctor. It's a prescription. It's a death sentence. You know, isn't it ironic when they were talking about the Affordable Care Act at one point, you know, they were talking about the idea that somehow if you were going to talk to a patient at the end of life, that it was a death conversation. Well, you know what? We're not even having a conversation. These people are just not getting access to health care, and it is a death sentence, only no one's talking about it. We just sort of walk away.
Yeah, I think you're correct there. I think one thing we haven't mentioned yet and shouldn't forget about is, you know, I'm sure you've heard about surprise bills.
Oh, yes.
You know, that's another problem that people face, and it's this, you know, in places where there's only one or only few providers, they have really large power to basically set the prices, you know, or not even enter into contracts with insurance companies. And then again, you're making the access situation worse for patients because, you know, they're left either not getting care or being surprised by large medical bills as well.
Well, I posted something on Facebook this morning about the cost of insulin, you know, and you're looking at the cost of insulin going up, you know, 100-fold. And they're finding out more and more people are not able to access their insulin because they can't pay that bill. You know, to go from $99 to something going to $345 for the same thing that you need, it's life and death. And I keep thinking, this is not an improved system. This is a system that if Big Pharma wasn't happy about the ACA, they figured out a way to be happy with the ACA because look at the cost of insulin. They're making their money there. So it's just, to me, it is shocking. But I guess my question to you is, you do all this study as a professor, how do we get people to understand what it is they need? And what they need is actually not insurance. What they need is medical care. And that medical care is not insurance. And we have so conflated these two, Simon, that it becomes problematic because people think that insurance is the answer. But you just talked about surprise billing. We just talked about being in network. We just talked about, you know, we didn't talk even about, you know, our co-pays and whatever else. And it seems like Americans are so naive about them, one of the most important things they think they need and they want.
Well, that's a really tough question. I don't have a quick answer for you. I think one of the big challenges we face when it comes to healthcare is that, you know, most people in a given year have very limited interaction with the healthcare and insurance system because they're relatively healthy, right?
Right.
On a given year, mostly you have a cold or something and maybe get a flu shot. And the worst thing that happens to most people is like either given birth or something like that. But it's really the people that are really experiencing the shortfalls that we have in our healthcare system and insurance system are like 5-10% every year, the people that have cancer, the people that, you know, have diabetes.
Yeah.
And those people are really seeing the shortfalls that we're experiencing where the rest of the people aren't. And it's quite challenging to explain to people these kind of things. Although I have to say, you know, with the healthcare system becoming more and more profit-driven, which is something we've really seen in the last 20 years or so, you know, ranging from hospitals to pharmaceuticals and doctors themselves, you know, eventually it will be the point when enough people have seen it and experienced it, and there comes a point when everybody will be so fed up with the system of, you know, medical providers and
right.
insurance companies and everyone else basically just coming after patients to maximize profits.
Yep.
And, you know, it feels to me that we're getting closer to this point with everything that's going on with insulin and surprise bills. And
exactly.
Stuff like that.
I do think to some extent we are getting to the tipping point, and I think that it's becoming more and more obvious. And I think part of the problem with this whole idea of the tipping point is that more and more employers don't want to be in the position of of paying for health care. More and more employers are looking at independent contractors. They don't want to even have employees anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have employees, that means you're not responsible for anything in the way of benefits,
yeah.
which means, I mean, the future of American workers is this. You're on your own, Jack. That's kind of like the title of what's going on. And all that means is that you're just that much more vulnerable. And I want to remind everyone, too, that one of the big problems with the profit-driven thing is when I was having insurance back in the 1980s, I had a nonprofit insurance company called Blue Cross Blue Shield. Today, most of those nonprofit insurance companies are now for-profit insurance companies. So again, the whole way we have formed healthcare is now so been driven by the profit motive. And that doesn't mean that we're getting better healthcare. It just means everything is more expensive and more of us are making really unconscionable choices like Sophie's choice. Do I take this pill or do I take that pill? And that isn't a prescription for getting healthy. So thank you very much. I don't know how we explain this to people, but I think we have to do it. And I'm hoping that we do reach the tipping point. So I appreciate you're joining us. Thank you so much, Simon.
It was a pleasure.
Take care. I'm telling you, this story is, it's 1984. Think about this. They're running in Cottage Hospital, and they're screaming up and down the hallway, she has insurance. Do you know why I ran for office? I ran for office in 1984 because of health care. That's why I ran. And you know how depressed I am? Instead of seeing it better, it's just gotten worse and worse and worse, and there's a greater level of vulnerability. More friends of mine I know are making choices and are going bankrupt. It's just so immoral, and they're afraid of Medicare for All or health care for all. Why? What are you giving up except some rich guy, you know, being able to, you know, cut his coupons because he's making so much money?
Right. Well, similar experience to what you're talking about with, oh, my God, she has insurance, only in reverse. You know, the big class action that we brought when I was at NHLA against the state Health and Human Services was about 58,000 children in the class who were eligible for dental care through Medicaid. And their parents had the same experience. You know, mom calls 50 dentists, every dentist in the phone book, and talk about my child is screaming in pain and there's blood and whatever else it is. And they say, oh, you have to come in right away and we can fit you in tomorrow and blah, blah, blah. And then
Medicaid.
The last thing they ask is, well, what insurance do you have?
Yeah.
And they say Medicaid and click. The medical office, the provider hangs up because Medicaid wasn't reimbursing enough to the providers, so they wouldn't even take Medicaid as an insurance.
And now,
it's like your people screaming, oh, they have insurance, they have insurance.
It's just Medicaid.
That makes the difference between getting care and not getting care.
But it's also now, I think Medicaid and dental care only applies to children. Does it apply to adults? I don't think so.
Medicaid does not cover adult dental care.
See, you know how I know? Listen to this.
Yeah, because from the North Country and half the people are toothless.
This is
all Medicaid would pay for is extractions for adults.
Well, this is the unbelievable story. They just founded a sort of a homeless shelter for women, okay? So they were given like a bed and like a little tiny sort of kitchen, and they shared a bathroom. And they were opening – I can't remember what it was called, like Rosemary Center or something like this. It's 1996. And I'm walking past one of the rooms, and there is this incredible stench coming out of the room. And I said, what's going on there? Her mouth was rotting. All right? I said, well, take her to a dentist. She isn't covered for dental work through Medicaid. I said, so what do you do? They said, we can pay for fumigation for the room, but we can't cover her for her dental work. So they're constantly, literally fumigating the room because they're not able to use Medicaid to actually treat her mouth. Mm-hmm. I went so berserk. I called the Dental Society and I said, send someone down to do it for nothing. Treat her. Treat her. But look at this. Look at how stupid we are. It's not that we're not spending money.
We'll fumigate
about it.
The room.
Exactly. They were spending money anyway because it was, you know, it was an approved expense. But they couldn't do what would have eliminated the approved expense because they would have treated her mouth and then she would have had a life. But she didn't have a life because she was rotting. She was rotting. Right. I will never forget that. And I'm thinking there is something sick here. And what is sick is our healthcare system. And that was 1996. And here we are still fighting the same fight. And we're not – we keep talking about the more people that were able to access the Affordable Care Act. But look at the prices that are going back up. So just because you have coverage doesn't mean you can afford it still. It's right. Just heartbreaking.
Exactly.
All right, darling, what do we end with?
Well, we end with a rural hospital that may be closing and no longer providing health care to anybody. It's St. James's Infirmary by the Preservation Hall Jazz Band.
I love it. Here we go.